Welcome to Ahval Forum. As 2020 coming to a close, today we wanted to review the 2020 and discuss the highlights of Turkey's domestic and foreign policies of 2020 with two distinguished guests today. The first one is Ms. Binaz Toprak, who is a political scientist and former parliamentarian for the opposition party, Republican People's Party. Welcome to the program, Binaz Hanım.
Thank you.
And the second distinguished guest is Mr. Haluk Özdalga, who was also a member of the parliament representing Ankara for two terms till 2015. Welcome to the program, Mr. Özdalga.
Thank you, and good day to everybody.
Good to see you, all of you. Well, as I mentioned, we are going to talk about 2020 and then also a little bit of 2021. And I will ask you, what would be the expectations, especially on the foreign policy. But let me start with 2020. Ms. Toprak, please give us your highlight. What did you see in 2020, whether in domestic affairs or if you like to also wade into foreign policy in this first question, you may also. Thank you.
Thank you. Not much good, to tell you the truth, as far as 2020 is concerned. I want to start with a recent article, an interesting article I read by a political scientist called David Landau. And the title of the article is Abusive Constitutionalism. Now, he argues that today, authoritarian governments by military rule through military coups are out. Instead, what we have is competitive, what he calls competitive authoritarian systems. That is to say, on paper, these systems have democratic-looking constitutions. For example, on paper, there is separation of powers. On paper, there is rule of law. There is election. There is free press, free assembly, freedom of speech. There's rule of law and so on. But in reality, what's written on paper, that discourse on paper and the reality doesn't fit together. Because what these autocrats do is through informal measures, they make sure that these remain on paper, that they're not true in real life. How do they do so? For example, by appointing friendly judges, or by intimidating judges, or by buying judges off, or controlling the media, again, by intimidation, for example, press and the media, controlling the NGOs through election fraud, through intimidating and criminalizing the opposition. As a result of which, it's very, very difficult. It becomes very difficult to dislodge these autocrats from power. Now, this is a theoretical argument, article. It's not about Turkey, but I think it perfectly fits the Turkish case. That's what's been happening in Turkey. As you know, we had a referendum in 2017, which changed the parliamentary system into what's called in this country, or what the government called, the presidential governmental system. Now, as you said, I'm a political scientist. I don't know of any literature, political science literature, that talks about a system like this. I mean, there are presidential systems, that there are semi-presidential systems, there are parliamentary systems, but I never heard of a presidential governmental system. It's unique to Turkey, and there is no equivalent of it in the rest of the world. Since then, you know, since this system was adopted, what Landau talks about has happened. In other words, there is no accountability of the president. There is no transparency of the presidency. Parliament has become totally powerless. This year, 2002, was the, I say was because it's almost over, was the 100th anniversary of the establishment of the Turkish parliament. And there were big celebrations and speeches given as to how important the parliament is. And it represents the will of the people. It represents the sovereignty of the people and so on by governmental dignitaries. But again, the discourse doesn't fit the reality because the parliament has no power, nor does this will of the people makes any sense. You only have to look at, for example, what has happened to the mayors of the Kurdish party, HDP. In last year, in 2019, in the municipal elections, HDP gained 65 municipalities. Today, only 5 of them remain. The rest of them are being governed by government-appointed trustees. The power of the parliament to draft the budget for next year, which, when you look at the history of parliaments in the world, is the very raison d'etre of why parliaments exist. I mean, historically, it was the people who wanted to control who gets what, you know, how money is distributed, that these parliaments were established. Now it doesn't have that power either. It's the president who drafts the budget, and the parliament cannot even reject it, because if it rejects it, the last year's, it's written in the law or the constitution that last year's budget will be put into effect. So, you know, the parliament doesn't have the power to reject the budget that the president made, but also other restrictions of his power, which I won't go into detail. It cannot oversee cabinet ministers. It cannot have hearings and so on and so forth. But I think the most important one, and I'm sure Mr. Özdalga will talk about these too, is that the case of the judiciary, that it has no independence whatsoever. And just like Landau explains, the judges are intimidated so that, they do whatever the executive branch wants, basically. Even though the discourse is that the judiciary is independent, there's gross violations of rule of law. There's long periods of detention in prisons. And by long, I don't mean 5 days, 7 days. I mean 3 years, 5 years. The case of Osman Kavala is one in point. Today, the Constitutional Court, even though he's been in jail for over 3 years now, the Constitutional Court decided again, despite the fact that the European Court of Justice ruled in favor of Kavala just last month, and previously several times before, decided that he has to remain in prison. Why? There's no verdict against him. There's no court verdict against him. He's being detained without any proof that he committed any crime, because I've attended these trials, and really one gets the feeling that these are mock trials, because the prosecutor shows accusations, talks about accusations without any evidence at all. There isn't a single evidence against him that he has committed all this, these crimes, including, for example, spying for other countries. I mean, it's incredible. So, you know, the judiciary, the economy is in a terrible change. Or Turkey has problems with in foreign relations. I don't know much about foreign relations, but I know that Turkey is in trouble vis-a-vis its relations with the European Union, its relations with the US, its relations with neighboring countries, increasingly resorting to the use of military power in order to intervene in these countries. And then, you know, claiming that Turkey is surrounded by enemies and that the very sovereignty of the nation is in danger, that we're in danger of extinction and so on, which of course increases ultra-nationalist feelings among part of the population that supports him and this ultra-nationalist party with which he's in a coalition. The pandemic, mismanagement of the pandemic, incredible brain drain from the country, especially young professional people, well-educated people are leaving in mass. So all in all, and all of this, and terrible polarization to such an extent, there are almost two different Turkeys inside the country. So all in all, I don't want to completely dominate, but all in all, when you look at 2002, I mean, these trends that have been in the making for a long time now have become even worse and even heavier and so on. So it's very difficult for ordinary people to breathe in this country. You know, freedom of the press, freedom of thought and speech, freedom to assemble, these are all curtailed. People are afraid to open their mouths. There's incredible criminalization of the opposition as terrorists, as enemies of the state, as spies for foreign governments and so on. Hate speech against opponents. You know, the country looks bleak.
Okay. Well, this was a bleak picture. I will go into more details in second tour, asking more about pandemic and polarized country that you mentioned. But let me move to Mr. Özdalga and get your take on 2020 and how this administration, Erdogan administration, handled the country.
Okay, thank you. Well, I believe the great majority of the Turkish people will remember 2020 as a very bad year, except for those who are very close to the ruling party, AKP. And I can give many examples for this, but I will take up only three. 2020 actually has been a year of multiple defeats for the ruling party, for the AKP, multiple defeats. Mm-hmm. I will take up only three examples: economy, democracy, and foreign policy. In economy, in economics, 2020 has been the year of perpetual poverty. I will explain. Perpetual poverty. In democracy, we have had the collapse of the rule of law in 2020. And in foreign relations, in international relations, it's been the year of deep isolation. Maybe the deepest isolation Turkey has ever had for the last 98 years since the foundation of the republic, entire Republican period. If you look at them shortly, economy, well, 2020 has been the seventh year in consequence that Turkish people got poorer and poorer. 7 consecutive years, starting in 2013, every single year, Turkish GDP total, and in my opinion, more important, GDP per capita went down. It was, for instance, GDP per capita was in 2013, it was $9,000. It went down all the way, and last year, 2019, it came down to 9,000, from 12,500 to 9,000 last year. In 2013, it was 12,500, and last year, 2019, it was $9,000. Now in 2020, according to the preliminary estimates by IMF and by other experienced economists, the GDP per capita is $7,800. It's a terrible drop in 7 years, consecutive 7 years, and it went down 38%. If you take into consideration the buying power of the US dollar, Turkish people have been poorer in 7 years, almost about 50%, if you take into consideration the buying power of the dollar. Well, coming to the democracy and the rule of law, Ms. Toprak explained in detail, but I will try to give a comparative and numerical picture, because it is very difficult to give numerical pictures in rule of law, like in economy, for instance. But there is an association, very famous, very well-known association, World Justice Project, it's called. And they publish every year, they publish a detailed index for all countries, almost all countries in the world, for the rule of law index. Rule of law index. If you look at the rule of law index published by World Justice Project for 2020, Turkey takes the 107th place among the 128 countries. What does it mean? 107 over 128 countries. What does it mean? If you group all the countries in the world in 5 groups, 5 categories, Turkey is in the 5th group, at the bottom group. So we have a 5th class democracy and 5th class rule of law. But this is a general index. There are many parameters, like transparency, like corruption, and etc. But if you look at it more specifically, like the independence of the courts, civil courts or penal courts, the situation of Turkey, position of Turkey is worse than that. Turkey is at the bottom of the 5th class. There are only 3 or 4 countries in the whole world where courts, civil courts or penal courts, are more dependent on the political power than Turkey. This is a terrible picture, and we just have seen today a new example of it today by the ruling of the Constitutional Court. You know, this is a terrible situation. And if you look at the international relations, foreign policy, Turkey is in an isolation which never had before. Historically, traditionally, there are 2 big geographical areas which are significant for Turkey. It's the Middle East and the West. It was before Europe, but now I say West because it's Europe and the United States together and the Middle East. If you look at Turkey's position in the Middle East, except for the tiny Qatar, Turkey is on a bad terms or terrible terms with all countries in the Middle East. Syria, Lebanon, Iraq. In Iraq, in a very difficult situation, Turkey, and Turkey is wiped out. Excuse me, Turkey is pushed out of Iraq and left Iraq to Iran. Iranian influence and the U.S. influence. Historically, we have been very strong there for the last 500 years. And this is for, and if you look at the Arabian Peninsula, for instance, we are on bad terms with all countries, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, all of them. If you look at the West, Turkey, let's look at EU first. Turkey is not a candidate country for EU membership anymore. Its candidate status is only on paper. This is simply because the AKP party turned the tables in EU issue, which is strategically very important for Turkey, and our relations with the US is the same. Turkey has extremely bad relations, you know very well, in Washington with the Republicans, with the Democrats, in the Congress, in the major institutions like Defense Department and State Department and everything. If we have time, we will talk more about this, how it could develop after this Mr. Biden takes over in the White House. So this is the situation. This is a year of multiple defeats for the ruling party, AKP. I can give more examples, but these three should be enough, I think.
Okay, thank you so much for this overview. Let me do a very quick follow-up with that, Mr. Özdalga. So the government officials, starting with the President Erdogan, usually say that it's because Turkey is getting more stronger and more assertive in the region, whether with the Blue Homeland or other regions. That is why basically practically the whole world standing against Ankara, including, you know, United States and all the other EU countries. What would you say to this argument?
I know this is the story, or this is the narrative they have. And actually, I have written on this, and I expect the political opposition to challenge this narrative, but they don't do it. First of all, they say this is the first time Turkey follows an independent foreign policy, and because of that, all the world are challenging us. This is not true. All the Republican governments in Turkey, to the right or to the left, to the right of the center, to the left of the center, have always followed independent foreign policy. This is a great distortion of fact. They say we are the first ones to do it. It has nothing to do with that. Instead, they are following not independent foreign policy, but they are following an ideological foreign policy in the Middle East and in the West. In the Middle East, their policy is based on Ikhwanism, Muslim Brotherhood ideology. If you want to explain the AKP's foreign policy vis-a-vis any country in the Middle East, in Libya, in Egypt, in Arabian Peninsula, in Syria, you cannot explain it without referring to the Ikhwanism. Look at Egypt. AKP government has been attacking Egypt and Sisi as the greatest enemy since 2013. Why? I have asked this question in the parliament to the foreign minister. Please explain. The only reason they do it is ideology, Ikhwanist ideology. They say because we are against the coup d'etat in Egypt. No, it's not true. They have been the biggest supporter of the coup d'etat government in Sudan. In Sudan, just to the south of Egypt. There has been a recent coup d'etat in Mali, which foreign minister in the world visited Mali for the first time in the world. It is the AKP's foreign minister. It has nothing to do with coup d'etat. It has nothing to do with Turkish national interests. Everybody knows this. It's because coup d'etat has been against the Ivan regime. So this Ivanism has nothing to do with our interests. And Egypt is a very important country in the Middle East. It's the biggest Arabic country. It's a big power in the whole African politics. And we have very significant issues together with Egypt. For instance, just they've been talking about the Mavi Vatan, blue homeland. If you are going to support Turkish interests in the Mediterranean Sea, if any Turkish government will try to be the champion of Turkish interests in the Eastern Mediterranean, the first thing they should do is to cooperate with Egypt because of the geography, because Turkey and Egypt sees each other in the widest possible angle. And this will be to the benefit of Turkey and benefit of Egypt. But in spite of that, because of the ideological policy followed by the AKP party, they achieved the impossible. They pushed Egypt to the side of Israel and to Greece and to Cyprus. And if you look at the West relations, it's the same thing. They move with anti-Western ideology. Their assumption is this. On this assumption, they act. Anti-West ideology. What I mean by anti-West ideology, of course, everybody is free to criticize Europe, the United States, and I do it often also, but not on the basis of any ideology, on the basis of national interests or what they do and such things. We have disagreements sometimes often, but the way they look at it, their motivation is ideology, especially if you read the supporters of the AKP in the media. They explain that. I don't want to go into the detail. We can see it.
Okay. Sure. Thank you so much. Let me follow up with Ms. Toprak. One of the notions that you touched, that the AKP government has been very assertive, and but the opposition is not challenging this rhetoric, even though the defeats very obvious, whether in the foreign policy arena or the domestically. Ms. Toprak, you are not only a very influential figure in the academic world, but also in the opposition. You were yourself a very former parliamentarian. You have been involved greatly in the Turkish politics. This is going to be the final round. I would like to get your input in this. Do you think the current opposition with the new breakaway parties, Babacan's and Davutoğlu's, both coming from the Mr. Erdoğan's party, obviously in addition with the main opposition party and other parties, do you think in 2021 the opposition can challenge Erdoğan? And also one of the topics has been discussed whether you expect an early election in next year. You are on mute.
I didn't want to make noise while Mr. Özdalga was speaking. Let me start with what you said last about early elections. I really don't know. Nobody knows. I mean, some argue that the AKP government, given all these problems, and especially problems with the economy, with incredible foreign debt, which Mr. Özdalga didn't talk about, incredible foreign debt and inability to borrow money from any source, because partially because of what we've been talking about, is bad relations with many countries, plus lack of the rule of law. Because you know, in order to borrow money, people have to trust you. In order to attract foreign capital, they have to trust you that you'll follow the rules. Whereas Turkey is totally unpredictable right now. So anyway, you know, given all of that, the pandemic plus economic problems, plus the fact that there are these two new parties on the center right, let's say, of Babacan and Davutoğlu, who's an ex-student of mine. Davutoğlu, that he will be, and given the fact that his in nationwide predictions that his votes are going down, that he might call for the president might call for early elections. I really don't know. I mean, he might wait, hoping that the situation, economic situation, will get better until 2023, when the elections are scheduled, and that is better to wait. I don't know. That I don't know. As for what will happen in the next elections, well, the municipal elections showed us, especially the one in Istanbul, despite all the election maneuvering by the government, maneuvering of votes and you know, discounting the results and repeating the election and so on, not being content with 13,000 votes in favor of who's now the mayor from the CHP, İmamoğlu, but then getting 800,000 difference in the second election. You know, considering all of that, and considering that the AKP lost 11 or 17, I'm not sure now. Was it 11 municipal governments, metropolitan governments? I think so, to the CHP. 11 of them, including Istanbul and Ankara. Izmir has always been a CHP stronghold, but including Istanbul and Ankara and so on, showed to the opposition, and I don't mean just you know, opposition parties, but opposition in general, to everyone who's an opponent of the present government, that it's possible to win elections, you know, if people can get together. And this is how a great many citizen platforms are working on now, you know, how to get the opposition together, how to get opposition NGOs and various groups together, as well as political parties, so that there's a united front in the next elections. I think it's possible. One major problem, of course, is that Turkey is a really divided country, and the electorate has been so polarized that the opposition parties who are trying to put together a united front have difficulty balancing one party with the other one. For example, how to include the Kurdish HDP inside the coalition when you also need the, if not ultra nationalist, but at least the nationalist E party of Meral Akşener, within the same coalition. I mean, you know, it needs quite a bit of juggling to be able to do that. How to, on the other hand, how to include these two new parties that split off from the AKP into the coalition when so many of the CHP supporters would most likely oppose this because they cannot stand to hear anything about the AKP or anyone who was involved with the AKP, some of them. So it needs a lot of working and a lot of juggling, but I think it's possible. And I think that's what the major opposition party, CHP, to which I belong, served in the parliament under their name, the so-called Social Democrats, has to do, in the coming days and so on. Also, at the same time, I think the fact that the government in the U.S. has changed, that Trump is gone and now Biden has been elected, might make a difference, because political scientists have also been talking for a long time now about waves of democracy. That, for example, when something major changes in big governments, in big powers, as it did, for example, when several empires, including the Ottoman Empire, the Austria-Hungary Empire, the Russian Empire, and so on, when these collapsed, there were several democracies founded in the world. And this happened again and again after the Second World War. There was a wave of democratic governments, including Turkey, which made the transition from one-party rule to democracy in 1946, immediately after the end of the Second World War. It happened again with the collapse of the Soviet Union, or with the collapse of these fascist governments in Spain and Portugal, and so on. So the fact that Trump is gone, and that there's a more establishment person like Biden, now the president of the U.S., might start a wave like this, you know, in several countries around the world, including Turkey. I think Turkey will find that, given its policy now, you know, several foreign policy issues that Mr. Özdalgar has talked about, problems with these issues and so on, I think Turkey will have more and more difficulty dealing with the Biden government to start with. So we'll have to see. I mean, I'm hopeful that things might change.
This is a very positive note. You both said that it's possible for opposition party, even very challenging and very difficult issues between them. You said that it's possible for the opposition to get together.
Yes, because they did it. They did it once, yes. You know, during the municipal elections. It can be done again, I think. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, it has to be done. You know, there's no other alternative. So in that sense, I'm hopeful. I'm also hopeful because Turkey has a very young population. I mean, the percentage of people over 50 or 60 is so incredibly small, out of 80 million or 82 million, whatever it is right now, we keep increasing. But it's so incredibly small. You know, a few years ago, it was 3,000 women over 50, you know, according to statistics. In all of Turkey, I was shocked. How is it possible? But it has a young population, and the young are more and more educated, even though many of them are leaving the country, and even though brain drain is a serious problem, especially when a lot of Studies show that many of the young people who remained in the country want to go. And what's even more interesting is that of those who say that if they had chance, they want to live abroad, young people who have supported the AKP are in the majority, which is a very interesting finding, I think, according to a new study based on survey research. But in any case, the president himself has said that he's disappointed that even though he has opened up so many universities, these young people who go to universities don't vote for him. They don't, because, you know, they see how other people in the world live, how they're free to say whatever they want and free to live the way they want to live and so on. You no longer, as unlike the past, you no longer can control the information anymore. You know, for a while they banned Twitter. Immediately, you know, young people kept saying, well, you do this and you can get into Twitter from some other way. And immediately, you know, people were using that other method to get into Twitter and so on. So you can't control it. It's impossible to control the social media. And they want a free country and a free society and so on. I think that when it comes down to it, it's going to be the young people who are going to force these opposition parties as well as the government party, because Turkey cannot possibly, you know, continue on this route. It's not any country in the world or in the Middle East or in this geography. It has this almost 100 years of a republican system behind it and then 600 years of a tradition, the Ottoman tradition behind it, of multiculturalism, of living together with different kinds of people without this kind of hate speech or without otherization of others and so on. And with institutions that were established during the Ottoman period, which one shouldn't undermine, and some of them were based on merit, not based on loyalty, as has been the case right now under this government. You know, merit-based appointments have all but disappeared. It's loyalty that counts, and so on. And these young people feel desperate because they cannot get jobs unless they're part of the government coalition. They cannot speak up their minds. They cannot. All they have is the right to vote. So I feel like they will vote. And they'll make
Thank
sure
you.
They go to the polls and so on. So we'll see what happens in the next election. I'm hopeful.
Well, it is great to hear hopeful notes for 2021. I just wanted to follow up this final question. We are a little over time. Mr. Özdalga, do you agree with Ms. Toprak? Do you are also hopeful for next year or two? And the second, what is your expectation for the upcoming Biden administration and the Turkey relations?
Well, yes, I agree with Ms. Toprak for the future of Turkey, but I'm not sure that the near future, like 2021, will be an easy year for Turkey.
I'm not sure either. I didn't say 21.
No, I know you didn't say it, but I had it as my own opinion. I know you didn't say it, but I am fully optimistic for the future of Turkey, and this dark period will be over. But we don't know when and how. And I am a little worried about 2021. And this is I've been telling before, months before. And just I would like to summarize with one sentence my previous explanations. The reason Turkey is deeply isolated in international arenas is not because AKP is following for the first time an independent foreign policy, but it is because they have been following an ideologically motivated poor foreign policy. This we should make this distinction. Coming to the important question, how will it be? And the question, the first, how will be the strategic cooperation between Ankara and Washington under Biden administration? And the second, if any Biden administration will exert any pressure on the authoritarian regime in Turkey? And these two questions are, of course, interconnected. I have been trying to follow the signals coming from the Washington since the elections for the last 2 months, almost 2 months. Just one point I will say, not much very signals, but there is one thing. I see that the people Mr. Biden is collecting around himself in the cabinet and others, almost all of them are so-called centrists, moderates in the Democratic Party circles. No liberals, progressives like Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, etc. And if you look at the three persons which will be most critical for relationship with the Turkey, Antony Blinken, Secretary of State, Mr. Jake Sullivan, National Security Advisor, but he will be dealing with Iranian issue most of the time because he is most competent in that, and retired General Lloyd Austin, Secretary of Defense, and especially two of them, Blinken and Austin, they will be mostly dealing with Turkey, and both of them are hardworking people. They know the area very well, and they have a long history of working together with Mr. Biden. They constitute a good team, but at the same time, I see them as not very strongly politically motivated persons. This is a remark only. Coming to the question, it can be in any way. It is difficult to give safe questions, but there is one issue, I think, which will make it or break it. Very critical issue, and this is the issue the parties, Ankara and Washington, they will take up early after I think, March, I would say, S-400 air defense systems, S-400s. If they can agree on the S-400s, then I think it will be more difficult for the Biden administration to put a lot of pressure on Ankara. But if they cannot come to a compromise on S-400s, then the situation will not be very nice, I think. And on S-400s, I have written several articles on this. And from the very beginning, I kept saying that AKP in the end will put those S-400s most probably in the garbage. I mean, in a storage and lock it up. Lock it up, and the wars, it's a very embarrassing situation for them because they've been saying that this is a question of national sovereignty, okay? This was not a question of national sovereignty, actually. This is a question of abiding by the rules of the club you are a member. This is not. But now, AKP, who's been saying that this was a question of national sovereignty, will give the control of the storage to Washington. This is something against national sovereignty. Because Americans, if they agree, if our people in Ankara say that, okay, we will put them in storage, they will not trust them. Okay, you put them in storage, but we want to have the control, they will say, if it comes to that point, and they will do it in the end. Why will they do it? There is a reason. Because all the observers, all not all, but most of the observers, most of the commentators have been saying that this is a done issue, the point of no return is passed, and they will not come back, etc. But there is one question. If this is F-35s, if Turkey doesn't get F-35s, which is the fifth generation military jets, so Turkish national interests around, and especially in the Aegean and the East Mediterranean, will be under great threat. And no government, because F-16s, we have F-16s now. And it is very hard for F-16s to operate them until 1930s. And they say we will build our own fifth generation plane, but it is very difficult. They say they will do it by 2032. But this is very difficult, and if they don't get cooperation from the United States, it won't be possible. So there are great risks for Turkey in the Aegean Sea, in the East Mediterranean, in other places. If any government getting into trouble this in these areas, it will be very hard for them to continue. Well, whoever the government is, so they will most likely compromise on S-400s, and it is not a big problem for them to put them into storage. But more difficult thing is they will ask for the return to the F-35 program. Yes, it also may be possible, but in my assessment, it will be very difficult to return to the F-35 program under the same conditions. So this will be very embarrassing for them. Either for the delivery time, or for the price, or for the very important base in Eskişehir, there would be the major operation and maintenance base in Eskişehir. Now they lost it. They have picked up a new site in Netherlands, in Holland. So they will just, it's like the story of Nasreddin Hoca, they will come back, but they will not have the same conditions. They will have lost a lot of things for nothing. And if they agree on this, so there are very many things with this moderate people around Mr. Biden, because look at the south of Turkey, there is a belt of instability. Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Iran, and they will look for partners. They will look for partners that just in Iraq, for instance. Iraq is at the brink of economic collapse. And many other things. We don't have time to go into detail. And same in the north of Turkey, in Ukraine and Russia. So if they come to my guess, but it can be anything, but my more probable, if they come to an agreement on S-400s, including F-35s, they might find a way for modus vivendi, I think. I know many people think otherwise, but we will see in some 2-3 months. Okay.
Okay, well, thank you so much for your time. Two great minds, very important, influential thoughts we have heard here, and some hopeful notes for 2021. And hope to talk to you soon again. And again, thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.